We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Next week, people in Iran will be marking the 31st anniversary of the Iranian Revolution, and some people will use it as an opportunity to demonstrate against the government. Continuing protests, touched off by last June's presidential election, have been the biggest that the country has seen since the 1979 revolution, and the government of Iran has responded with force. This morning, in this hour, we'll review some of the current political situation in Iran and talk about the government crackdown against dissent. And our guest for the program is Mahmoud Manshupuri. He's faculty member of the Department of International Relations at San Francisco State University. He's also taught a number of other places, University of Georgia, Central Michigan University. He's also served as visiting fellow at the Yale Center for International and Area Studies at Yale University. He specializes in human rights, identity construction, and globalization in the Muslim world. His most recent work is entitled Muslims in Global Politics, Identities, Interests, and Human Rights, and that was published just last year by the University of Pennsylvania Press. He's also working on a book tentatively titled Getting Counterterrorism Policy Right, Alternative Strategies. He also currently serves as editor of the Muslim World Journal of Human Rights. It's a publication of the Berkeley Electronic Press. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the local number is 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that, 800-222-9455. And also, you may email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. In any case, certainly questions, comments as we continue here through the hour are welcome. Professor Manshupuri, hello.
Hello, how are you, sir?
I am fine, thank you. And yourself?
I'm doing fine, thank you. It's an honor to spend an hour with you and with your audience.
Well, we're very pleased that you could give us some of your time. I know that you just were recently in Iran. We have certainly heard stories, and some people have seen video, in fact, that people have taken of the demonstrations there. So we know something of what's going on. But if you go there, you have an opportunity to be there and to talk to people. Is it possible for you to talk a little bit about what the mood in the country right now is?
Unfortunately, the last time I was in Iran was May 2005, when was the first time that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was in the runoff for the election. Mm-hmm. But recently, I came back from a trip to the Persian Gulf region, but I had it researched. I had to do some work in the United Arab Emirates and Doha, Qatar, when I was working on migrant workers' human rights and things of that nature. But the last time I was in Tehran was 2005, but I've been following the news very, closely, been reading and speaking with members of my family and friends back home. And so I have had actually constant contact with basically what's happening on the ground in Iran.
Well, then let's start there and just tell us about some of the things that you are hearing from people who are there.
Well, I think the most interesting development in the last 8 months since the June 12 elections have been the rise up the Green Movement, which has really been a watershed in peaceful demonstration against the Islamic Republic, with its leaders basically being the former leader of the country in a coalition that brought Mir Hossein Mousavi, Rafsanjani, former president of Iran, Khatami, former president of Iran, Kahroubi, former speaker of the House. You see, all of these people, the leaders of the Green Movement, basically were, at some point or other, they were the pillars of the revolution. So the Green Movement was very authentic, was homegrown. That came from within the Islamic Republic. It wasn't something which was sort of fed from outside. Something kind of different from the color revolutions that we saw in Ukraine and Georgia and other countries with a little bit of sort of influence from outside, whereas the Green Movement was purely, I mean, domestic, and it grew out of within the pillars of the revolution. And so that was something very, very genuine about this movement. It was very much homegrown and had a tremendous appeal, and nobody can actually put any label outside controlled sort of orchestrated movement, and that was the something that was very, very attractive and appealing about that movement.
Yeah. I was very struck by some recent comments from Mir Hussein Mousavi that appeared on his website, where he was really talking about the fact that at one time he truly believed in the potential of the revolution.
Sure.
And has said some of the, what seemed to me at least to be some of the most critical things that he said so far about the government, talking about how disappointed he is, how at one time he believed in the fact that it could achieve much, and how at this point now, how disappointed he is. And so yes. It sounds as if to have someone with the credentials that he does say that's important.
That's very important. That's as far as he can get, because he said that, I assume that we have read the same thing. He said that the revolutionary goals have failed us.
Yes.
And we haven't, you know. It's a very interesting thing. I recently published an article in Middle East Journal in which I said that the Islamic Republic fought the Shah's regime on a platform of freeing up people from tyranny and corruption and the economic decay, but it just happened that Iran, the Republic now is charged is faced with the same charges today. And so I've said that history has a way of coming full circle, and it has actually eventually caught up with Iran. And so I named the subtitle of my article was that Islamic Republic Green Movement coming full circle. And so that's the irony of this revolution that was supposed to be a new day for the people who fight corruption, but now it's charged with actually rigged elections and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. What I wonder if you can talk some more about the Green Movement and who, what kind of people make up this movement?
Well, this is, like I said, it's a coalition, a sort of loosely put together coalition of former leaders of the country who have actually served the Islamic Republic at one point in their time, And now they have separated themselves from the leaders who are very much living in the revolutionary era. The Green Movement is a movement that came from within the system, saying that the time has come for Iran to move into a post-revolutionary mode, and we need to face with the new realities, the world which is globalized, the world that is more in line with international cooperation as opposed to conflict and ideological differences and so on and so forth. So we see this is a movement led by those from within the revolutionary Iran who are actually taking Iran, and they plan to take Iran to a different level, and they want to actually move Iran in a direction of post-revolutionary Iran. But then you have Ahmadinejad, who's a populist and revolutionary guard, and some conservative hardliners within the clerical establishment who are still very much adhering to the Islamic, revolutionary precepts and principles, and they are very much traditionalists. And so that's basically a fight between the modernist element and traditional elements within the same regime.
Yeah. You talked certainly about the importance of the fact that the Green Movement has people in leadership, people like Mir Hussein Mousavi, who was at one time Speaker of Parliament, Mehdi Karoubi, or Mir Hussein Mousavi was Prime Minister, Mr. Karoubi, he was the Speaker of Parliament, and then you have Hashemi Rafsanjani and Mohammad Khatami, people who had very important positions were highly placed in the power structure.
The president, both of them, the last two people that you mentioned, they were two-term presidents of Iran.
Yeah. Yes. Among the people on the street, who are the people that are supporting the Green Revolution?
Well, I would say largely middle classes. Perhaps in certain areas, segments of the country, we see lower classes. And I do not want by any stretch of imagination to underestimate Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's popular base. He certainly has some base because of his populist politics. He certainly has some base, and one should I would caution those who would say that Ahmadinejad is totally refuted within the Iranian politics. He certainly has a base. But that said, the middle class, I would say lower middle classes, even upper middle classes, are with Mousavi. And Iranian revolution was not really a lower class revolution. It was pretty much a middle class revolution. And something about the Iranian population that needs to be said is that if you look at the clerical superstructure, which is ruling Iran, is ruling a society that has in many respects grown even more secular and globalized. Among the Middle Eastern people, I don't know of any people in the region that is more internet savvy and more politically savvy than the Iranian. And so the dilemma that the Islamic Republic faces, and for which it has no solution, is that it is ruling a country which is, you know, very much secular in their belief and very much globalized. They're connected with the rest of the world. The average Iranian kid nowadays, they don't get their messages from mullahs in the neighborhood. They're connected with internet. They go and get the information, Google information, and they're connected with the rest of the world. So the Green Movement represents that portion of the Iranian society, which is a large portion of Iranian society, by the way, which is very secular and globalized.
Now, I think that it's true, and you touched on the fact that Mr. Ahmadinejad, his electoral success has in large part been built on his appeal to working class people, more disadvantaged people, people sort of on the lower end of the socioeconomic scale. And what he did was he made a lot of promises. He certainly did this the first time that he was running, made a lot of promises about how he would make their lives better. And I think that a lot of people would say that actually didn't happen. Has that affected the support that he gets?
Well, you're right. I think it's important to know that Ahmadinejad himself was born into poverty. Actually, that's why he's capable of making appeals to the poor classes. That's why he's, you know, unlike other groups within the system, he's not a corrupt person in the sense that he hasn't really amassed a huge wealth or something. Some of the people that actually are on the leading side of the Green Movement are like Rafsanjani. They are known for sort of being sort of a corrupt and well-to-do within the system. Ahmadinejad lives a very modest life, so he's been actually... he's made a lot of appeals and successfully to the poor classes. As far as the economy is concerned, of course, he has not been able to move the economy forward, and there is a tremendous discontent with his policies. And one of the things that he's trying to do right now, which I think the parliament, he has faced the challenges from within the parliament, is that he wants to actually bypass the corporations or companies or institutions that are responsible to subsidize, and he wants to put actually cash in the hands of the lower classes, which is very appealing to the lower classes, instead of actually saying that we're going to actually subsidize things like gas and bread and other things for you. I'm going to put annually some money, some cash on the table of these families. And so they like this idea. It's very, very appealing to them. But, you know, this type of populist solutions are really they will fall short of coming and to a head with the major problems of the country economically, speaking, that they require tremendous, you know, sophistication and dealing with the globalized economy and integration into the international community as far as the economy is concerned. And populism is appealing to the lower classes because they do not understand the nuances and subtleties of this complicated economy, and they see cash in front of them, and so that's very appealing to them. So to the extent that Ahmadinejad reaches to the people by very simplified and very easy solutions for the economy of the country, it, you know, it attracts the lower classes. But at the same time, he does not understand the complexity of the economy, you know, in 21st century, and all of the difficult questions having to do with finance and banking at this time. And so that's why the lower classes like what he does, and they provide the bedrock solid support for his chances for the elections. Some people said that he really had a good shot of winning the election. Had the elections not been rigged, he still maintained a good chance of winning the election.
Mm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Mahmoud Manshupuri. He's faculty member of the Department of International Relations at San Francisco State University. He specializes in human rights and globalization in the Muslim world. His most recent work is entitled Muslims in Global Politics, Identities, Interests, and Human Rights. It was just published last year by University of Pennsylvania Press. We're talking about Iran, and questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. As you have mentioned here, and I think as people will know, that the demonstrations that we're talking about here that have been going on for some time were indeed touched off by last June's presidential election, which in which the winner was certified by the government to be Mr. Ahmadinejad. And a lot of people, particularly supporters of Mir Hussein Mousavi, felt that there was fraud here, that Mr. Ahmadinejad was not, in fact, duly elected. Though, having said that, are we talking about here a phenomenon and a movement that has been growing, and that this was the proverbial match, but that it was something that was just waiting for something big to come along to get people out in the streets?
Yes, indeed. David, you are making a very good point. This was not sort of a spontaneous movement that came out of blue or came from nowhere. The tremendous discontent within the society, and also the fact that the previous election of Ahmadinejad, there were some, of course, clouds over that. All of this led to this huge, humongous popular discontent, and actually led to the people's coming to the street. And again, these uprisings are not a passing phenomena like the student protests of 1999 or 2003, which were actually immediately put down by the regime. This movement is actually demonstrates Iranian popular resolve, which is very firm. And some people say it's a reminiscent of the civil disobedience in India before the independence of 1947, or in civil rights movement in the American Deep South that led to great openings for the African Americans, and finally, of course, to civil rights that they won. And so the Green Movement in Iran is very much reminiscent of that sort of deep-seated movement that is coming from the grassroots, from bottom-up, and it's going to survive a lot of upheavals. We're going to see that eventually. My guess is that, my sense is that from what I'm reading these days, that there would be a compromise between the two sides. The compromise would achieve one thing, is that at least it will reduce the level of violence between these two factions. And from the signals that I see Mir Hussein Mousavi is sending, that is to say that he is talking about releasing political prisoners and freeing up the press, but he never talked about regime change or basically saying that I want the removal of Ahmadinejad from the power. So there seems to me that there is some compromise in the offing, but nevertheless, the movement, the Green Movement, is so deeply embedded in the culture of the middle class that I think will go on for some time.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation, someone who is listening to us this morning in Mattoon. They are on line number one. Hello.
Hi. I've heard so much about the youth in Iran and that they're secular, they're modern by our Western understanding. And I guess I suppose I'm just curious, with that spirit, Mousavi, the green movement, how far would they go? And what relationship would they have with Khamenei and those type figures? And what could we expect as far as, I guess, more about their policies and what we would see, what that would mean for their relations with the West and in real specific terms? And if they would survive any sort of transition there with the status quo and combined with the Green Movement. And thank you.
Right. Excellent questions.
Yeah, the caller makes a very good point. 69% of the Iranian population is below the age of 30. So we are talking about a very, very young population, demographically speaking. It's a very young population. And like I said before, they do not take the lessons from the local, the clerics. They are connected with internet. They are all over the place. They use, you know, Twitter. They constantly get information from the rest of the world. They're connected with the rest of the world. And they represent the so-called secular and very modernized and globalized segment of the population. And mind you that 64% of the graduates from universities are female. So now you have not only the youth, but you have the female population who are striving for their rights within the Constitution of Islamic Republic and other things. And I think Mousavi is very aware of the fact that he can tap into this human capital, human resources, that could actually lead to openings in the system. And so the youth in Iran are very much at the forefront of the political landscape and change in Iran. And I think there would be a critical force to be reckoned with in years to come. And then when this youth actually gets to the point that they've reached their 30s and 40s, and I think they're not going to actually tolerate anybody from the clerical establishment to tell them, you know, exactly what kind of government they have to have and what kind of social restrictions they have to tolerate in the name of Islamic Republic.
Maybe you could talk a little bit more, because I think this was one of the questions that I was interested in you seeing if maybe you could shed some light on what it, for the people who were involved in the Green Movement, what it is exactly they would like to see happen, or perhaps what sort of changes would they like to see?
Yes, I mean, David, this is a nonviolent political movement, and that's what's so appealing, and that's what the clerical establishment doesn't know how to deal with that, because it's not a violent movement. It's a very peaceful movement. What they want, they really do not want a change of the entire system, which is the Islamic Republic, because the leader of this movement basically are the former leaders of the Islamic Republic. So they do not want a tremendous or drastic change in the system. They want reforms, and specifically they want to see social restrictions lifted. They want to see economic improvement. And mind you that if you look at last data that I looked at, the Iranian economic situation, we had more than 16% unemployment rate, about 16.5% inflation rate. And so employment and jobs are the key issues. And so they want to actually see two things: economic recovery, economic, you know, betterment of conditions, and also they want to see social restrictions being lifted so that they feel much more comfortable in terms of socializing boys and girls in the streets and in parks and other places. And they actually look at the Western world. They're connected with the rest of the Asia, and they see that the country is socially restricted and they do not have all kind of civil liberties that the rest of the youth in the world is enjoying. That's what they want. There's nothing really complicated. They do not want the overhaul change of the system. They are not looking for another revolution or violent revolutions. I think they have learned the lessons from the revolution of the last 30 years.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Mahmoud Manchipuri. He is associate professor in the Department of International Relations at San Francisco State University. We're talking about Iran, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a caller here to talk with. Next in line is Champaign County, line 2. Hello.
Hi. I heard a Iranian labor activist, I guess he's touring the country and has been in the Bay Area, so you might have heard or maybe even met him, but he was suggesting the subsidy lifting in March was going to be a possible pivotal time. He is with the Greens in some way, though he probably has a different analysis of the economic road forward as opposed to some kind of nebulous globalist kind of get with the economic system of the world. I mean, prospects of getting down with the economic system of the world as the economic system in the world is in total chaos is, seems to be problematic. But I was just curious, he didn't mention the fact that this, the subsidy lifting is actually related to a change in some tax policy or something. This is maybe too much in the weeds, but I'm curious why that's the way it's happening. It seems to me that I don't know. Is it making them too cagey to suggest that they want to get out? They're expecting sanctions. They're expecting economic problems to get worse, and that they might be able to. This is the current regime might be able to portray the coming economic deprivation on what already exists as deprivation. This would be deprivation for the lower classes.
Sure.
Can be more easily blamed on the sanction regimes that the U.S. is so steadfast at putting in. I wonder also, it seems to me this arms transfer to the region that the U.S. has just arranged, along with more signals to Israel that there is a time limit, et cetera, on the nuclear issue. I don't know. It's a very confusing circumstance for me because I'm the one who keeps bringing up the fact that the $400 million of CIA destabilization money that the Bush administration authorized with the Congress through this 2 years before the end of the Bush administration, actually redounded to Ahmadinejad's a benefit. It seems to me, if you can actually say we are actually being undermined by the world superpower, and they've actually blown up a mosque in the Baluchi region 10 days before the election, that would concentrate the mind of the hardliners in a very unproductive way from point of view of the Iranians themselves. I'm sorry to lay so much out there, but it's such a complicated circumstance, and I guess I'll just ask you to.
Yeah. Well, let's do that. Yeah.
Yes, it is, and all the points that the caller makes actually are part of this confusion and complexity of the picture. It's not a very easy picture. It's not easy to understand and predict things within that. On the point that. Iranians are going to actually move in the direction of putting, you know, cash as opposed to subsidizing things in the hands of the lower class. I explained that this is part of the populistic sort of policy that Ahmadinejad is pursuing. He is pursuing it through the pure revolutionary steps of reaching to the people who actually made this revolution, and so they wanted to actually benefit from that. He had that audience, he had that constituency that he tries to satisfy. But I explained that before, that this will cause a lot of problems, and he has actually offered this package to the parliament, and parliament is not in favor of passing that. So there are people within the Iranian Majlis, which is the term for parliament, who think that this may not be possible because Iranian economy is based on heavily subsidizing things as opposed to actually putting cash in the hands of the people. These are some of the policies that Ahmadinejad is pursuing. And as the caller said, it might be related to the fact that the Islamic Republic feels like they're going to be under tremendous, maybe fourth, fifth round of sanctions, and therefore they have to protect their constituencies so that they can actually control the uprisings of the sort that we just talked about. And so that's one thing that we need to be actually to put that into proper perspective. On the question of whether or not the stabilization package in Iraq or Afghanistan has in some very indirect way have supported Ahmadinejad's policies, and there's no question that the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq and the fact that they have not really produced the results that they were intended to produce have helped the hardliner conservatives in Iran, who would argue that the United States is in the region to actually mess up the economy, the politics of the region, and then exploit that. And so the Iranian hardliners have always benefited from rallying people behind the flag by saying that this is what the Americans have in store for us if at some point they decide to actually resort to military actions against Iran. Any attack on Iran, unfortunately, is going to consolidate this regime in power. This is the last thing the United States should do. So I strongly support Obama's approach of engagement, sitting down with Iranians. And mind you that a few days ago, I think it was on Tuesday, that the Iranian actually came up with a new offer accepting the uranium enrichment to be actually done outside Iran. And so they talked about countries like Brazil, Turkey, and Japan, and possibly Russia to be the countries that they can exchange actually fuel to let go of this low enriched uranium and get the much enriched uranium for medical and cancer related purposes. So Iranians are actually making some overtures, and they seem to be moving in the direction of some kind of compromise with the international community, because they fear that if the United Nations and the United States push for fifth or fourth, I don't know which round of sanctions we are, if they push for more sanctions, they're going to make it extremely difficult for the Iranian regime to survive.
All right. I hope that gets at least in part to the questions of the caller. We have some others. We'll continue going to Champagne for the next line, number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Ahmadinejad has been very vocal in his in saying that Israel must be destroyed, that the Holocaust was a myth. And I wonder if the caller could speak to could give his perspective on whether that feeling is widely shared by the population in Iran. Is it the base of support that Ahmadinejad relies on, or does it include all sections of the Iranian populace?
The answer to that is emphatically no. I mean, resounding no, because the average Iranian, they do not really care that much about what's going on with Arab-Israeli conflict. They are not sharing the point. Ahmadinejad, when Ahmadinejad talks about, uses this kind of odious rhetoric, he has about 350 million people constituency in the Arab world. And that may resonate among the Arab constituency that he has. this message of talking about, you know, wiping a nation from the map of the from the map of the world, or denying the Holocaust. These are things that do not resonate deeply with the Iranian population. In fact, there is tremendous sympathy towards the persecuted Jews and what has happened to them in the interwar period, the Holocaust period. And Iranians really are not anti-Jew, and anti-Semitism is not really as spread as you see that in the rest of the Middle East. In the Arab world, the story is different because the Arab world has had four or five wars with Israel. They have been, you know, humiliated. They have been defeated by the Arabs. So there's deep by the Israelis, I should say. There's deep resentment in their hearts against this Israel and Israeli policy. Whereas Iran is a different thing. Iran is a non-Arab country. People are very much pro-West, and I think it's timely to talk about a very paradoxical phenomena in Middle East, and not too many my good friend American friends would recognize that. The population in Iran is pro-West, whereas the regime is at least self-proclaimed anti-West. And take this case and reverse that in the Arab world. That would be the case in the Arab world. You have a population which is against West, in large part because the establishment, the regimes in power in Egypt, in Jordan, in Saudi, other countries, they are pro-West. So you see that the Iranian population is not a typical Middle Eastern population.
Yeah, interesting point. Let's talk next with someone in Muhammad, line number 3. Hello.
Yes. Could you talk a little bit about the Revolutionary Guard and how strong they are? The impression one has is that it might be shaping up as sort of a battle of uneducated youth with guns versus educated youth without them. And kind of in the same vein, is it possible to have significant social liberalization and still have the maintenance of what would be called an Islamic Republic?
Yes, that's a very good question, and I'm thankful for that question. There are approximately, I would say, 147,000 Revolutionary Guards, and Revolutionary Guards are the backbone and bedrock support. They provide the bedrock support for Ahmadinejad. And what we have seen since this June election, we have seen that Revolutionary Guards are basically controlling major levers of power to the point that the conservative clerical establishment sometimes finds itself under tremendous pressure from the Revolutionary Guard. Revolutionary Guard have their ideological wing, which is called the Besigi. And Besigi are the people that Besigi translates literally into the people who are capable of mobilizing. And so one extended arm of the Revolutionary Guards are the Besigis. Besigis are the ones that are active in the streets, are vigilant. They are actually attacking the demonstrators and so on and so forth. But anyway, Revolutionary Guards, which is entirely different from the army, because the army is something different. In Iran, you have Revolutionary Guards, which are actually the major supporters of the President Ahmadinejad. And sometimes Revolutionary Guards are known as Sepah. And so Sepah actually is the core of the power in Iran. And some people, like Gary Sick from Colombia, wrote an article and said, Gary Sick argued that we have seen a kind of soft coup in Iran engineered by the Revolutionary Guards, and now the Revolutionary Guards are actually controlling the levers of the power, and it's the Revolutionary Guards who actually control the financial and the banking sectors, and they now they have confiscated the political power, and they are in charge. How is a country, faced with economic and political liberalization is going to actually accept the existence of this core group running the country? That seems this is one of the obvious contradictions of the country that its leaders, at least whose leaders believe in modernity and change and globalization. So Revolutionary Guards are basically in charge right now, and that's what the meaning of the soft coup is. And so that's a very, very interesting phenomenon, that even the clerical establishment now is not shunted aside, not even threatened, but at least to some extent I would say that they have been marginalized in terms of political power.
Something that I want to make sure that we talk about, and we're getting kind of short on time, is what can be said about what has happened to, what we know has happened to, the people who have been involved in protests against the government. We certainly know that many people have been arrested. Just recently, two people were executed. Other people apparently have been sentenced to die.
Yeah,
what do we?
Nine people are in line to be executed. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Perhaps you can talk some more about that.
Well, this shows that the regime deals with the opposition in a very brutal fashion. And the more we see these examples, the more one gets the feeling that the regime is so insecure, it feels so insecure and so threatened that they cannot tolerate any opposition that even is on the street level peacefully demonstrating. And so that's why this violent reaction we have seen against demonstrators and now these executions have raised a lot of questions about the human rights status of the human rights conditions of the country. Again, this is an example that the Islamic Republic is inching toward more brutal tactics and brutal reactions because they feel insecure and they feel like this uprisings or demonstrations may get out of hand. So they want to nip it, if I may use that expression, they want to nip it in the butt right now before they get to the situation where millions of people are taken to the streets and are threatening the pillars of the Islamic Republic. So Islamic Republic is very insecure, very, very insecure. And so this brutality is a clear sign of it.
Is it, do you think it is the case that the government has thinks that if they continue to be tough like this, arrest people, execute some people, that if they continue to put that kind of pressure on the Green Movement, that it will wither, or at least that it won't grow?
Well, yes. I don't think that they believe that they can actually see that movement fading away. Like I said, Green Movement is not a passing phenomenon like a student demonstrations was some years ago. This is something that shows the firm resolve of the people and what they want to do, they want to kind of control that and curb that movement. It will not wither away because it's homegrown, domestic, it's widespread, it's grassroots, and it's in the hearts of the people, and you cannot actually control this movement. And it's interesting when I look at the revolutionary movements of the 20th century, most of them show that basically it was the social power, not the military power, that actually caused the change. And so Iranians strongly believe in the social power, and they know that this social power is a tremendous asset to them. And that's the only way they can control, they can fight, they can combat against the military power of the regime. So how do you actually make a movement based on a social power wither away? It may not be possible to do that, but you may be possible by raising the magnitude and scale of violence to control that and contain that. I think containment is the best word that I can use here. And that way they can curb certain, actually, developments there. And eventually they have been successful. Revolutionary regime sometimes have been able to rationalize violence, and that way they have been able to control the movement. But in the case of the Green Movement, I believe that this movement shows a degree of activism which has created a political space in Iran for itself, and is not backing down. And the regime should recognize that political space. And this is what the regime is doing, but at the same time is kind of threatened by the magnitude of that movement if it actually deepens to the point where they cannot control that.
Mm-hmm. Next, as I mentioned at the beginning, next Thursday, the 11th, is the sort of the day officially set aside as the day to mark the anniversary of the revolution, the 79 revolution.
And 31 years.
Yeah. All along here, I think the people who have been involved in the opposition in the Green Movement look for days like this, look for particular important days to encourage people to get out into the streets. And so we see on important days like that, we see demonstrations. What do you think we might see happening next Thursday?
Well, I think I would like to see something like a breakthrough or something in my visual thinking. I think about that, you know, February 11 is going to be a date that will actually be a watershed day for the Green Movement. It will actually take to the streets. But my sense and my reading of what I read and what I actually understand, and sometimes occasionally call my friends back home. Some of them are professors at the university. Some of them actually in non-academia work for NGOs. The feeling that I get is that we should not expect very much. Not much will happen on February 11, but this is a movement that will continue. It's almost a stopless, and it's, you know, again, one of those days that it'll come and we'll see some demonstrations and some conversation between ministers and so on and so forth. But we should not read too much in that.